That's Wynton Kelly on piano and Yusuf Lateef on tenor sax opening up Who's Blues. That's from Paul Chambers on bass. That's from his 1961 album, First Baseman. Tommy Turrentine, older brother of Stanley, on trumpet. Of course, Chambers on bass. Lex Humphreys on drums. Wynton Kelly, as I said, on piano. And, of course, Yusuf Lateef with that sweet, wonderful saxophone. The legendary Paul Lawrence Dunbar Chambers Jr. was a jazz double bassist and composer born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but growing up in Detroit after his mother died. A fixture of rhythm sections during the 1950s and 60s, heavily influenced by bassists such as Oscar Pettiford, Ray Brown, Charles Mingus, George Duvivier, Percy Heath, and Milt Hilton. And it was Duke Ellington's bassist, Jimmy Blanton, who made the greatest impression on him. Blanton brought new dimension to the bass in the 30s, making it more an integral part of compositions as opposed to just a rhythm keeper along with the drums. Chambers' bass, you can hear him opening up Miles Davis's So What. His professional career, though, was short-lived, lasting only about 13 years. He was prolific, one of the most recorded bassists in jazz. He died of tuberculosis on January the 4th, 1969, at the very young age of 33. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Monday, September the 22nd. And what a wonderful historic moment it was yesterday. It was indeed that. But we will talk about that in the second half of the program. In the first half of the program, I want to talk about a study that was done earlier this year by Harvard University's Institute of Politics. And the study found that young Americans, 18 to 29 years old, are not all that interested in voting. Only 23% of the participants in that study said they planned to vote in November. Their trust in government is, quote, at a five-year low, unquote, and their, quote, cynicism toward the political process has never been higher, says the director of the study, Trey Grayson. And so they are opting out. Interestingly, disillusionment with politics was more prevalent among Democratic participants than conservatives and Republicans, said the study. The conservatives and Republicans, in fact, were the most enthusiastic about midterm elections that just concluded and the November elections ahead. Young people aren't the only demographic that are turned off by politics in general, and the Obama administration in particular. So is opting out going to catch on, and is it, in fact, a good strategy? That's what I want to talk about today. Now, it may sound very unpatriotic because, after all, voting is democracy, we're told. Voting is American. Voting is the way you express responsible citizenship. You're a good citizen when you vote. You, after all, are a participant in the democratic process. But more and more, there is the palpable feeling that there's a mile's worth of distance, between the voters and the people who they're voting into office. There's a dramatic turn that has taken hold in this country. And it is all the more surprising because supposedly this is a very, quote, liberal, unquote, president. This should be the moment where the country actually becomes even more active, more involved in voting, mirroring the enthusiasm of 2008 and 2012, when this bright, young, bushy-tailed very youthful guy with great ideas and message of hope, appeared on the scene and reinvigorated a rather moribund political field and got people all excited. But the young people may be telling us something. They have spotted the leopard. They have seen its spots, and they are turned off. And so they're not going anywhere to any other side. They are also turned off by the other side. So they are just opting out. Now, you heard me here talk about the need to leave the Democratic Party, especially for African Americans and Latinos, people who are oppressed in this country but continue to support one of its the chief vehicles of oppression, which is the Democratic Party, and the political process in general. There are communities in the United States that don't vote and have everything they need. And yet, I'm looking now specifically at the African-American community. It has outdone almost all other ethnic communities, particularly in the last two presidential elections, in voting. It voted at a higher proportion than any other ethnic community, and it voted for the president, and it voted, most importantly, for the Democratic Party. And that has been a trend for several decades now. But they're voting, and their schools are crappy. They're voting, and there are no jobs. They're voting, and they just are at the bottom of the economic ladder, consistently. Okay, all of this is happening consistently. They're voting, and they are at the very top of the misery index. In Detroit, they're voting, and more than 150,000 households have no water. They're voting, and there isn't a single public school in New Orleans. They're voting, and there is no special prosecutor in New York City and in Ferguson, Missouri. But they're voting, and they plan on voting for this wretched Democratic Party. And the good news, actually, that came out of Ferguson just last week was that even the African-American Democrats in Ferguson have decided to form the Fannie Lou Hamer Political Coalition. Why? Because they are sick and tired of being sick and tired of being disrespected by the Democratic Party. I mean, I was hoping they would just cut ties. They aren't there yet, but it's a significant move. And very, very symbolic. So the young people are telling us something. They're saying there isn't anything available that is genuinely speaking to us. And that is whether it is Republican or Democrat, conservative, libertarian, or even any other alternative party at this point. They're just opting out. They've fed up with the whole thing. And they are on to something. And we should really take a look at that. This isn't just about feelings and, you know, that would dissipate and it'll change their mind in the next 10 minutes. The study seems to suggest that there is a pattern that has been established here. And these young people, these young adults, 18 to 29, have actually sounded the clarion call, a wake-up call for the American electorate to get real about this political apparatus that it keeps encouraging with its vote, no matter where on the political spectrum they vote. But the process is now increasingly meaningless, because when you vote, you are not participating in a democratic process. These people go down to the Congress and the U.S. Senate, and they go to the local city council and the state legislature, and they do what they want to do. Take the current situation. A large percentage of America is against the war, but will the government ever say a situation this grave, this serious, requires a national referendum so that we don't do anything that the people don't want? We must ascertain the will of the people, and so we will have a plebiscite. We'll have a national vote on this question: should we go to war? They won't do that. They're not that brave. I should say they're not that honest. Because a whole mechanism is driving this war and this move to war. A whole complex industry depends on war. And it must have its way. And it will have its way because it has that level of clout. It has its tentacles smack in the middle of all of those secret rooms where these decisions are made behind closed doors. And you voting, and you thinking, well, that entitles me to some kind of leverage on the throttle and brake of government. And you are so wrong. You couldn't be more wrong. More and more, voting is mere symbolism or a mere mathematical requirement so that person A or person B or party A or party B could get into office. We do know that you elect people, you don't have a hand in selecting. They are presented to you by a corrupt political organization as the candidates from whom you may choose. And of course, like lemmings, you go and you flick the lever and you say, okay, well, there's Busby and there's Fred and there's, Sally. I'll take Busby. You don't have any reason to. You don't know what that means in terms of what you are legitimizing by your vote. So there isn't a neat meeting of the minds between the process of selection and the process of election. Somebody selects the person that you are now required or encouraged to elect. You have nothing to do with this process. It explains, for example, how Hillary Clinton could walk out of the White House as the wife of the president. Actually, she was co-president of the United States, but could walk out of the White House after her, husband's little trouble there, and walk into the U.S. Senate, never having to run for cat catcher or dog catcher or a rat catcher and move up the ranks like every other Democratic stiff. You just got to go through the motions. No, you can walk right out. Because the system works the way it desires. And now, twice now, if she runs in 2016, will be twice a candidate for president of the United States. Fully entitled, she believes, to run the country. Fully equipped and fully qualified to run the country. A woman who was Secretary of State and said, as a former Secretary of State, that basically, she was surprised by ISIS. With all of the intelligence gathering capability of the agency that she ran, with hundreds of thousands of employees and relationships with other spying agencies with the government, she was surprised. Such is the leadership capacity that she had within the State Department. But I come back to this notion again of what is voting supposed to do for you? What is it supposed to mean? And we're told it is democracy in action. And I beg to differ, and 23% of the participants in this study also differ, and I'm with them. I don't know if you recall the story I told you about myself. Finding myself in a voting booth, in the voting booth, I made up my mind, I would say almost 15 years ago, I was no longer going to vote without a compelling reason. I was in the voting booth when I made that decision. I was the world's most, if there were a prize for the world's most conscientious voter, I would have won it. I and a group of stalwarts, we used to crack up every time there was an election. We would arrive, a small group of about seven of us. We would always find each other at the polling station, even before the people running the polling station showed up to set things up. We were so early, so eager. And my ritual was down. I'd get there, you know, dispatch this wonderful civic duty, and then go directly to breakfast at my favorite diner in Queens. I lived in Brooklyn. But I would be able, at my favorite diner, to spread out all my papers and read all my news for the day before my program. But I was an extraordinarily conscientious voter. And then there I was. I mean, you would agree, I'm not boasting, but you would agree I'm fairly conversant with the issues. Fairly. And I'm in the voting booth, and I find myself going down the ballot, and I'm seeing things that never were discussed, as referendums that had to be voted yes or no, and people running for judgeships. And we're supposed to vote them in. Nobody knows who they are. They're not allowed to campaign. So we have no idea who they are. We have no idea about their judicial record. We have no idea if they're even sane. We have no idea who these people are. So we're voting on the basis of, and I say to myself, oh, look, I'm going down the names. Do I like this name? Does it resonate well with me? Do I like that person's face? And that was the basis of which, as a fairly intelligent person, that was the level that I was sinking to in the process of exercising this precious right to vote, because I was a conscientious citizen and I was contributing to this democratic process, which was extremely undemocratic to me. And right there in the voting booth, I just canceled out all the levers I pulled. I just said, forget it. I will register only that I've been here, but not that I have voted for anybody. And I remember that lever that you pull so the curtain could open and you can get out of the booth. It sounded so much like, you know, the lever the hangman pulls. Very symbolic, because it was a kind of lynching in the phone booth. And I pulled the lever, and that was the end of that. I said, no, I shall not be voting again until there is a compelling reason to vote, a compelling and strategic reason to vote. And since then until now, I haven't found it. My friends were stunned when in 2008, I did not find it with Barack Obama. I I said, there's something missing here in this man. Something is missing here. He's well choreographed, well scripted. He is almost too perfect. But at the same time that he's muttering these things that are clearly scripted for him, we get no inkling at all of who he is at the core. And for me, as a black woman, it was very important for me to get a sense of who he was and is as a black man. What is your orientation vis-a-vis the status quo? Or are you very much for the status being quo? And we found out that he was very much for the status being quo, and I made my decision about him then when he decided that he was going to participate in the lynching of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who made that speech that everybody was freaking out about, God damn America. And when you study the speech, you see he was right on target, speaking in the noble tradition of the black preacher, bringing people very, very, very dramatically to understand the realities that they were living in, and therefore what they had to do to protect themselves politically. It was a very passionate speech. And while white America seemed to think that it was calling for the destruction of America, he was saying, in fact, that America had strayed from whatever it had identified as its spiritual moorings that informed, in turn, its alleged political commitment. Anybody seeing the speech would get that, but people get scared about people having passion in their speech. But Barack Obama decided that he was going to hand up his spiritual advisor, a man of great accomplishment in his community, many, many years of dedication, unswerving dedication, a man with deep commitment to liberation of his people. In fact, he was practicing, in the midst of practicing, liberation theology. And when he did that, I said, well, that does it for me. This man is not to be trusted. This man has no core. This man has no principles for which he's prepared to stand up and defend himself and others. So when I saw that, and it went so against the grain of what my father would have done, and good men I know, they would not have done that. Men of principle would never have done that. I said, well, that cancels that vote. And it turns out I was right all along. But the process of voting has to be of strategic value to the voter. What am I getting? What am I investing in? And the young people are saying, we don't see yield on our investment. We don't see that what we will be getting in return for pledging our troth to this political system, we don't see that it's measuring up. And if Americans really started doing some forensic auditing, we would not have had and continue to have the sad spectacle that we're seeing in Washington, D.C., where these men, and I use the term advisedly, for the most part, they're men, are making some decisions that would throw the entire nation into havoc and possibly pave the way for a global catastrophe. And what they need more than anything else is the legitimacy of their illegal actions and their barbaric actions. They need the legitimacy. They need the cover of the people's vote. what happened to the people and their sense of honor? What happened to the people who believe that they also have the charge as a voter to keep the government in line and keep it straight, keep it at least in line with what it says it's about? What happened to the peace movement and liberal-leaning and progressive people? Where are they? Where is the march? Where is the pronounced outcry? I contend that people should revisit this whole idea of the vote and how they use it and express it. And while, especially for African Americans, and I say that because so much emotion and history are tied up in this franchise, and there seems to be the industry that is formed, where you have these people like Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and others who are now the paid servants of the Democratic Party to trump up a vote. No, they don't care how you get into the booth. Just go there and flick a lever. And their time with you is done. And it's mostly not about you. It's mostly about them proving their worth to this party that so despises, as the people of Ferguson have finally come to admit to themselves, the party despises you. But there are people willing to be of service to it, even if they also join in oppressing you and hoodwinking you and fooling you. So the time has come for people across the spectrum to reevaluate this business of voting. And I believe it would be a good thing to not vote for strategic reasons. And not just not vote, but not vote very loudly. Do not vote very, very loudly. Announce to the world that you refuse to be a pawn in a game. You refuse to aid and abet this kind of brigandry. You refuse to be a part of a lie. You refuse to participate in your own oppression. When somebody shows up who is worthy of your investment, you will make the appropriate decision. But until then, there's nothing that should compel you to vote for these underqualified and super calculating people. Absolutely not. When people decide that they really are the determinants of a democratic society, that's what the word comes from, demos, meaning the people. And democracy isn't really about voting anyway. The way you measure a democracy, I've talked about it here on this program before, you don't measure democracy about how people are voting. The true measure of a democracy is the degree to which all the people who are voting have some relatively equal access to the strategic resources of the society. That's how you measure a democracy. Are all the people can they reasonably count on feeding themselves every day? Do the people have housing? That's a strategic resource. Do they have a means of making a decent living to support all of their needs and the needs of those that they love? That's a measure of democracy. Do they have good educational systems? Are they safe in their communities? These are strategic resources. Isn't it odd and ironic that in the so-called primitive societies, societies that we say are so primitive and crude, it's perhaps some of the most startling examples of true democracy. Everybody eats or nobody eats. If there's one fish, everybody gets a nibble of it. Everybody has a house to lay their heads at the end of the day. They have some shared way of building their homes, so nobody is homeless. Everybody takes care of the children. Everybody has access to the medicine man or the religious advisor who is their, you could call it their healthcare expert. No one goes unattended. But in our society, our democracy says something else. We don't even know what it is. But I'm telling you, if you apply that formula, the degree to which the citizens of this nation who are voting have relatively equal access to the strategic resources of our society, I would think you'd conclude we don't have a democracy here. We don't. So we should pay heed to these young people, 18 to 29, the demographic that is actually showing and leading the way, trying to wake us up. Will we listen? Who knows? I'll take this break and come back and talk about that historic march yesterday, right after this. That's Paul Chambers on bass. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. It was certainly historic. As many as 400,000 people, the reports said, coursed through Midtown Manhattan yesterday in the People's Climate March in vivid demand for world action on measures to curb global warming. The United Nations, by the way, tomorrow hosts a preliminary climate summit that will lay out an agenda for a major international conference on climate change next year in Paris. So the march coincided with this preliminary climate summit here in the United States, in New York City. But there was much about the climate march that was kind of troubling to me. And this is not to just say, well, you know, you just can't please that woman. It's not about that. Because I noticed certain things. And first I take in the visual, and what did I see? What I saw, and of course, it was very spectacular, very impressive. You can't ignore 400,000 people anywhere. That's great. That's big. But it also says that there was a strong, for lack of a better term, a public relations or effort that was made to turn these people out. Very good organizational skills. But it still had that ring of a kind of parade as opposed to a purposeful march. It seemed, I mean, there was all the stress about the most historic, the greatest, the largest, you know, this is the biggest march ever. And it seemed as if that in and of itself was one of the goals, to be able to boast about the historicity of the march, not that it caused something to happen, but that it caused a whole bunch of people to show up. And numerically, it just superseded, it exceeded everybody's expectations, and therefore, for that reason, it was historic. That's unfortunate. The march should have been historic because it accomplished something. And people would say, well, awareness, it accomplished an awareness of climate change. I said, yes, I will say yes to that. I would agree to that. It accomplished an awareness of climate change. But how? The awareness of climate change is good. I was expecting an agenda for climate change. I was expecting that 400,000 people showing up someplace would have a shared agenda, an articulated agenda, a goal in mind that is written someplace and that people could find out, why are 400,000 people here and many, many, many more all over the world to coincide with this march? Why? What do they want? I always ask that question. Why are you in the streets? Well, we want climate change. Well, that's good. I think that's a great idea. We all want climate change. But what specifically do you want? It was hard to tell. It seemed that what they wanted more than anything else was a historic march. And that in and of itself was a goal. But there's something troubling about this march for climate change and so forth. And again, I'm reacting from my own personal, my own set of personal issues, okay? Now, the march and the organization behind the march, they're repeating some very troubling things, and I talk about it all the time. And this is the trouble with the so-called liberal and progressive world. They had, of course, the sprinklings of that, quite a few people of color all over, I mean, making sure that they were distinctive in the march. But this march and the organization of the march still follows a very troubling model, and that is the leadership is not as diverse as it ought to be. And the march itself and the whole issue of climate change, I think, is fitting into a very surreptitious plan to give great leverage to private interests, private, corporate, political interests. It's no mistake that Al Gore was there. Well, you know, he invented climate change. And there he was at the head of the march, and Bill de Blasio and the political types. I was expecting, believe it or not, I was expecting a more leftist kind of thing, a little bit more edge to this march, rather than people showing up and having a good time. And I was expecting that because of my rooting in the environmental activism of African Americans and Native Americans in this country, who started this whole thing about, they were screaming, the black and brown and yellow world had been leading the march on climate change for decades now. They've been talking about it. But it wasn't until whites entered the picture and adopted the project and organized all these things that we saw, the Hollywood aspect, the high-profile political aspect, the corporate money aspect, the foundation aspect. They brought all these pieces together, just like any other corporation would. And now they created a movement, and the movement now dominates all other movements around the world. For example, it dominates the movement by the Marshall Islands, for example, that still are reeling from U.S. nuclear testing in their territory. It dominates the movement that's been going on in India and Africa for years, with the corporations coming in, just absolutely just tearing up the environment to get the oil or to get the lumber or to get whatever it is they want. In Brazil, in Guyana, what the mining companies have done to violate the heck out of the environment, to kill off entire portions of the Amazon jungle, poisoning the fish in the river, poisoning the people. We don't hear about Bhopal and the Dow and chemical tragedy. We don't hear about the huge environmental stories that have been screaming for attention. But this world does not deal with that. They have now said the issue is climate change because now it's about all of us. And you come into our fold. They don't have to reach out to you. You have to come into their fold now. Because why? Dare I say it? It's about money. Much of all of this is about money. And they're able to come to the fore as the great global authority because they have millions and millions of dollars. And they're operating just like any other corporation. And they're into all kinds of marketing schemes and whatnot to raise their own profile within this world because it pays, and it pays big. Really, it does. We'll be talking about this in another couple of days. But this is very troubling. Many, many years ago, when I was the editor of the City Sun, I had a reporter, Hugh Hamilton, did a splendid job on a special edition on environmental racism, using Harlem as an example of all the things that were so wrong environmentally in Harlem. It still stands today as the only such report, it's in the Library of Congress, the only such report on environmentalism in the African-American community. The photographer was Peter Essick from the National Geographic, and we did a splendid, extended report. I think it was almost 32 pages on this one subject. Why is it that Harlem at the time was processing all the sewage from downtown Manhattan? They conveniently located the sewage treatment plant for downtown Manhattan, smack in Harlem. The bus depots at the time that were emitting all that exhaust into the community. And the community having one of the highest rates, all of the Black and Latino communities in the city of New York, the highest rates of asthma, and asthma that proves lethal to many young children and young adults. You had the noise pollution, unbelievable amount of noise. The subway runs underground under Tony Madison Avenue and comes up on Q at 96th Street, where the Black and Latino community begins, and then runs all the way to the Bronx as an elevated train, so you can hear that thing rattling for blocks and blocks away. And on the other side, on the east side, we have the Metro Rail, doing the same thing. The pattern in Harlem was mirrored all over the country, and that's what started the discussion of environmental racism. Cancer clusters, brownfields, people, malformations in people's physical makeup. The situation is the same all over the world. And the world had a case for environmental issues. And, you know, one of the major issues that they're not discussing as a contributor to environmental problems and global warming is what? War. War. You know what the effect might have been, or I would argue still is, of more than 8.7 million tons of bombs dropped by the United States in Vietnam? What does that do to the atmosphere? And you multiply Vietnam and Iraq and Syria and all these other wars that we've had, Russia, China, everybody's fighting. War, a major cause of global warming. Will they take this on? No, they're not talking about that because they're tied into the political process. And we will explore that. So, you know, all isn't as it seems. It is a great idea, and I am very much an environmentalist. The community has suffered so long from environmental abuses that have directly impacted on life, directly. And so when we see these things happening, and be mindful, if you see Al Gore, you're seeing the Democratic Party, you're seeing Bill Clinton, you're seeing Hillary Clinton, all these things are coinciding. And by the way, the Clinton Global Initiative is very much one of the major contributors to this whole thing. There's a lot of political mileage, and there is a very, very uneasy relationship between this so-called grassroots movement and the established political order. It should cause people to ask some questions. But I'm especially troubled that the whole environmental movement, like many of the other liberal and progressive movements, take the position that people of color just need to step aside. We will do the heavy thinking here. You just do the heavy lifting and showing up and doing whatever it is we tell you to do. But we really can't trust you to formulate really sensible approaches and alternatives here. We can't trust your intellect to participate in solutions. So we are keeping you on where you belong, where you are most useful in this fight. We have credentials, we know what we're doing, and you don't. And so, you know, we will give you the ceremonial nod. Yes, here's Vandana Shiva, who has been fighting this thing in India for years and years, decades, actually. She's been in the struggle against all of this. And we give a nod over here to this person and a nod over here to that person. But the control and the intellectual property will not rest with the people of the world who are suffering the effects of this climate change and other major environmental disasters that are no longer discussed and no longer spoken of. They are shunted to the side because they're not sexy. Climate change is sexy. It gets a lot of money, it gets a lot of attention. Those other fights, you know, we'll get to them. And yes, we support those too, but there's no advocacy along those lines. There's no advocacy around these issues that have been going on for decades and affecting lives for decades. We still have in Iraq and in Syria massive deformities still occurring as a result of the bombs dropped by the United States and now, by France and Britain and whoever else wanted part of the war. So I'm saying this, that part of the job of the progressive community is to call people out and say, this, we have to ask questions here. This doesn't smell right. And it's good, it's wonderful that people are undertaking this global initiative, but let's be real clear that there is a hidden agenda behind it as well. I want to thank you for joining me today. I hope this program brought some reason for you to rethink things or to cogitate things from the start. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Stay tuned. Wake Up Call is next with Richard Martin. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. As always, it is a great pleasure and an even greater privilege to be in your esteemed company. See you tomorrow.